Now, this talk has been called Buddhism and the New Reformation. The New Reformation, of course, is the title of the bishop's second book. That is to say, the one he wrote after Honest to God. We always call Honest to God his first book and the New Reformation his second, even though he had written quite a number of books, apparently, on various aspects of theology before he wrote Honest to God. It's a very small book, by the way, as most of you who have seen it remember. This is perhaps because the bishop realized very well that even though what he had to say was very valuable, if he had enshrined it, or entombed it, we may say, in a tome, a weighty tome of 500 pages, no one would have read it except the reviewers and the professional theologians. So he's produced a second little book of about just over 100 pages, which he realizes quite well is all that the average layman these days can stand of religion in one dose. Now, this book consists of four chapters. One is called Troubling of the Waters. Chapter 2 is called Starting from the Other End. 3 is called Towards a Genuinely Lay Theology. And 4 is called Living in the Overlap. All quite arresting titles, you'll agree. Now, each of these chapters is concerned with a particular problem or particular aspect of the problem, or perhaps we shouldn't even say problem at all. Perhaps to speak in these terms is rather too negative and defensive. Perhaps we could say that each particular chapter is concerned with one particular area of opportunity or area of challenge. Now first of all, let me say a few words about the title of this book of the Bishop of Woolwich's, The New Reformation. Now when one speaks in terms of the New Reformation, it suggests, of course, that there has already been an Old Reformation. The Old Reformation, of course, is that inaugurated by Martin Luther when he rather bellicosely nailed his, I think it was 94, I forget the exact number, of theses on the church door at Wittenberg. And it's out of this Old Reformation of Luther's, of course, that there eventually emerged that welter of Reformed and Protestant churches, some hundreds of them, including, of course, our own dear old Church of England. And the Reformation, of course, is the movement which we can say split Christianity into two halves. On the one hand, monolithically, as it were, the Roman Catholic Church, on the other, all the Reformed and Protestant churches. Now, that's the Old Reformation. Now, what about the New Reformation? The bishop, in his preface and elsewhere, thinks, in fact he's convinced, that the New Reformation, or what he calls the New Reformation, is already here, has in fact already begun. It seems that he thinks, essentially, that reformation means the adaptation of his religion, Christianity, to the needs of our time. He's very deeply aware, as we've seen in his book Honest to God, that there's a great deal of theological and ecclesiastical lumber which needs to be cleared away. A lot of it is kept up in the attic, of course, out of sight, but even that doesn't help us very much. He's of the opinion that even the attic ought to be cleared, or the lumber taken down, taken out, and just burned. And the essentials of the Christian message restated in a way that people can appreciate, in a way that they can understand. But of course, and he's very strong on this point also, without any loss of integrity. Now it's an interesting thing that the bishop is very well aware that this new reformation about which he speaks, and in which in fact he's involved, cannot be confined to the West. On one page of the New Reformation, he refers to Parinder's book, The Christian Debate, Light from the East. And he makes it quite clear that he's quite well aware that whatever is said on this sort of subject within the limits of Christendom, the Christian churches, is, as he puts it, overheard elsewhere by followers of other religions, especially by the Hindus and especially also by the Buddhists. Now I feel that we can go even further than that. It's not so much that Hindus and Buddhists and followers of other Eastern religions overhear what is going on in this way of the new reformation within Christianity itself. We can even go so far as to say, I think, that we, that is to say the Buddhists, are currently having a sort of new reformation of our own. Now that may not be very obvious to Western Buddhists. That's simply because they've comparatively little contact with popular traditional forms of Buddhism. But this new reformation, as we can call it, within the context of Buddhism also, is certainly, we may say, in evidence here and there in the Eastern Buddhist countries. With regard to the use of the term new reformation, in the case of Buddhism, this is perhaps a little out of place. It suggests, as it were, that like Christianity, Buddhism has had just one reformation. But in fact, we can say that Buddhism has had several reformations already. This, of course, raises the question, okay, here within the context of Buddhism, what exactly do we mean by a reformation? Basically, we may say a reformation is a restatement of the essentials of a religion in terms meaningful to a contemporary person. It's not just a sort of lopping away of the bad. That's what very often people tend to think, that a reformation means cutting out something or getting rid of something merely and preserving what is good. But it's much more than that. Reformation really means getting down to rock bottom, getting down to the essentials of what you think, the essentials of what you believe, the essentials of what you're trying to practice. Grasping just the essentials, even we may say the intangible essence, and putting it across in a new way, a way which is more immediately relevant to the needs of the people around you than any of the old ways of putting it. What you put across, or try to put across, that intangible essence, as I've called it, may be the same as what previous generations were trying to put across. But your way of putting it across must be uniquely your own, uniquely suited to the needs of your generation. And it's this sort of putting across, whether doctrinally or institutionally or in any other way, that we call a reformation. Now, Buddhism, as we all know, has had a very long history indeed. 2,500 years of it and a little more. And it's unthinkable, we may say, that in the course of those 2,500 years, Buddhism hasn't needed to restate its message, to put its message into fresh terms. If you say, or if you assume, that in the course of 2,500 years, Buddhism hasn't needed to restate its message, you're really saying, you're really making the statement, that in the course of those 2,500 years, people didn't change. The peoples among whom Buddhism was spread, among whom it was preached and practiced, didn't change. In India alone, Buddhism has a history of 1,500 years, say a period corresponding, say, to the 4th century of the Christian era in the West, to the 19th century. 1,500 years. So obviously, in a period like that, there's going to be a tremendous amount of change. Think how much we've changed in the course of 1,500 years. So certainly, the Indian of, say, 1000 AD in India wasn't anything like the Indian of 500 BC, that is to say, in the Buddha's own days. Needs were different, attitudes were different, outlooks were different. So this being the case, it's inevitable that in the course of its 1500 years of development in India, its 2500 years of total history, it's inevitable that Buddhism should have changed. Changed in the sense that its fundamental message, its essence, was restated again and again and again in accordance with the changed needs of the times. Now we know, as a matter of historical fact, that the message of Buddhism has been restated at least four times in the course of 2,500 years of history. In other words, we can say, we can assert, that in the course of 2,500 years of Buddhist history, there have been four major reformations. Now this may come as a surprise to some. Some may say, well, we've heard of the Reformation in Europe in the 15th century, but we've never heard of any Buddhist Reformation. We haven't even heard of one. What to speak of four? But this is perhaps because we have tended to be misled by words. We've all heard of the three jhanas. We've all heard of the three jhanas of Indian Buddhism. What are these? Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. Now these are usually described as schools of Buddhism, or even sects of Buddhism, a very unfortunate expression. But basically, these three jhanas, the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, are not schools, are not sects at all. They are really three successive stages in the development of Buddhism in India. I've gone into all this before, as some of you know. Or we may say, rephrasing it again, they are three successive statements or restatements of the essentials of the Buddha's teaching. The Hinayana statement, Mahayana statement, Vajrayana statement. And it isn't perhaps too much, it isn't stretching perhaps terminology too far to describe each of them as in fact a reformation. Now, there is a difference when we think or when we speak of reformation in the 15th century, in the 16th century, in Europe. We think in terms of blood and violence and slaughter and burning at the stake and forcible conversion. We've got all the bloody wars of religion which disfigured the face of Europe almost for centuries, until the final religious settlements. But of course in the history of Buddhism we don't have anything of that sort. We have reformations, but nothing forcible, no bloodshed, complete tolerance. And this is, of course, this fact is in accordance with the much more pacific and tolerant nature of Buddhism itself.